Are you here on 192?
Yes.
Okay. House Committee on Revenue for Friday, June 19, 2009 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 192. Day?
Chair Von Hart, members of the committee, good morning. This Senate Bill 192 is about Historic Property Special Assessment Program. Mm-hmm. It makes a lot of changes. Under the current law, Oregon's Historic Property Special Assessment Program freezes property tax rates for 15 years. The intent is to encourage reinvestment in historic buildings. According to Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, as of July 1, 2009, there are a total of 539 historic properties participating in the program. Over the years, there have been dozens of revisions that have complicated the administration of the statutes. So 2007 Legislative Assembly passed the Senate Bill 416, which revised the special assessment program by making it more a little restrictive, and it created a task force to scrutinize the program and to explore other options for encouraging and providing incentives for the preservation of significant historic buildings and sites. And this bill is in part based on the final report of the task force. Senate had four separate meetings on this bill, and this engrossed version, Senate Bill 192, reflects the issues and concerns that were discussed, and Parks and Recreation spent a ton of time and effort to make it workable and addressing all the concerns raised.
Right, and we only received it recently. Thank you. We have two members of the other chamber here to present. Please.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to refer to Senator Devlin because he has an engagement he needs to get to.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Committee members, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be relatively brief, but just because I'm brief doesn't mean that I don't believe that this isn't a problem. I believe what I'm going to present to you is a significant problem, although it's a problem for a limited number of Oregonians. I very much believe in the Oregon Historical Property Assessment Program, and I know you'll be making some decisions on that today. I'm here to speak about an element of the Dash 7 Amendment. This Dash 7 Amendment, I believe, includes virtually everything almost that's in the Dash 8s, but it includes another provision that deals with an issue that I don't think is an anomaly of this program and its interaction with 50. I don't think it's one of those inequities that is caused by 50. I believe it's 50, but I believe it's actually a travesty. I've been discussing this issue with the Senate Revenue Chairman for months, actually. I believe I've had at least 12 discussions with her. I have a great deal of respect for the chair of the Senate Revenue Committee, and I have a great deal of respect for my colleague here to my left, who has actually spent a great deal of time on this issue. The chair of the committee believes that there are a lot of problems with Measure 50 and that those problems ultimately need to be corrected, but at this point doesn't want to correct some of the inequities in the system until all the inequities can be resolved. I believe that's not appropriate in this particular case. I'm going to describe, and if Ms. Avey, are you here?
Where is he?
If you could hand out the handout from the constituent.
Where is he?
Okay. You have a handout. I would ask that you not look at it now because it'll be confusing to you right now because it is pretty extensive. Just let me go through just a few numbers here. This is a revenue committee, so you should be comfortable with numbers. I'm comfortable with numbers. But in 1992, when they entered the program, the assessed value of their property was $261,000, and the real market value was $261,000. That's how it would have been in most cases under our former property tax system. In 1996, of course, they were in the program, and their assessed value was still $261,000, but their real market value was $362,000. Just prior to Measure 50 passing, Their assessed value was $241,000, and their real market value had actually dropped. If you remember, we were in a recession in the early part, and the assessed value was $283,000. In 2006, just prior to getting out of the program, their assessed value was $277,000, and their real market value was $781,000. When they left the program, their assessed value went up to $648,000, and their real market value was $1,192,000. Thus, when they, well, the year before they left the program, their total taxes were about $4,300. And when they left the program, before they left the program, their total taxes were about $4,300. I repeat that, $4,300. After they left the program, their taxes were almost $11,000 a year, 155% increase in 1 year. Had they not been in the program at all, they had anticipated that their taxes would have increased, and actually, if they were a similar property that had not been in the program, their taxes would be about $6,300. I don't think that this is an anomaly. I don't think it's an inequity of Measure 50 in the interaction with this law. I think it's a travesty for this family that this issue hasn't been corrected. Now, there are not many families like this in Oregon. All you have to do is actually look through the web page for this and look at all the properties that are in the program, figure out which year they're going to come out of the program, and you will see how many families there actually are. Some of them will have experiences that are this dramatic. Some won't quite be this dramatic. But I don't think that this was ever the intention of this program. The program has very good goals, very good objectives that I think meet what a lot of Oregonians would like to see in terms of the preservation of historical properties. But I don't expect that anybody thought that anybody entering this program would face this. And I can tell you quite honestly, this was not in the spirit of Measure 50. While I know many people disagree with Measure 50, I was here during the development of Measure 50, and if you've ever seen what Measure 47 actually looked like, it was often compared to something that had been written in a kitchen with crayon. Because it had so many problems, it was unimaginable, and we were in a constitutional crisis, and we felt that the only way to actually resolve that crisis was to put something back on the ballot that the voters would vote for. But this was never anticipated when the drafters of Measure 50 put it together, and again, this is not just an anomaly, it's not an inequity, but it's a travesty for this family, and something should be addressed. The Dash 7 amendments have this issue addressed, along with the other issues I believe that Senator Walker will talk to you about. I quite honestly believe that we should be addressing this issue this session. It may be only a few dozen Oregonians that are facing this right now. There will be probably, I would guess, in the hundreds over the next several years. But I think this is something that was never intended and something that we should address, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
In the interest of time, we'll take questions for Senator Devlin now. I have one that's related to the issue you're raising. Based on what you've said, it sounds to me as though this is an interaction between the actual operation of Measure 50 in this instance and situations in which the real market value has markedly increased. Would that be a fair assessment?
It would be a fair assessment in one way. It's if the property had not been part of this program, the assessed value would now be $380,000. But because it was part of this program, the assessed value is now about $650,000.
And that has to do with the mechanics.
That has to do
with how the assessed value is calculated at the time the property comes off of the program.
Correct. I think the members of the committee would be familiar with these terms, but as it was explained to me by the legislative revenue officers, this is the changed property ratio that goes into effect. That is basically countywide, whatever the ratio is between a assessed value and real market value would be applied to a property at this time that they came off the program under the current way that this transition would occur. I just don't think it was ever intended like this, and it actually literally means that the person probably loses whatever benefits they had from the program within a year or two of this transition.
So if if you're in a part of the state where the property values have not increased markedly, this is would not likely to have much effect. Where, on the other hand, if you're in a part of the state where market values have increased a lot, like in the, as in the Tri-County area, then it would have a significant could have a significant effect.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe that would be true. It could be true both in areas in the metropolitan area. I would obviously believe that a person in Ashland that had a historic home would be facing this.
Or in Eugene.
Or Eugene, or many of the parties that might have a historic home on the Oregon coast.
Thank you. Any other Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, following up on that line of questioning, would it then be your opinion that perhaps in anticipation of future variability in the value, that there might be a deterrent effect on utilization of the program at the outset if one believed that there might be in the future a rise in large rise in property values?
I think that that's been an issue that's been discussed in considerable extent, and I believe that's actually true. Obviously, because of the tax system we're under, there isn't the same level of benefits actually to a person entering the program than that there were before because of the limitation on how much real assessed value can increase. But I think people would look at this very with a very skeptical eye of whether they wanted to enter the program. People sometimes believe that property values are high now. They are high now. Obviously, they have decreased significantly in the last year in some areas, but everyone anticipates that sooner or later they will come back. Even as high as they are in some of our cities and neighborhoods, they don't compare. They're relatively modest compared to some neighborhoods and metropolitan areas in the United States.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you,
Thank
Senator.
You.
We appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you.
Senator Walker.
Mr. Roper, you can rejoin us.
Yes, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. This is kind of an unusual situation in that you heard from Senator Devlin that he had several meetings with the Chair of the Revenue Committee. I will tell you that the Chair of the Revenue Committee had a little work group. I'll put quotes around that. Yet not one member of this task force, except for Mr. Roper, was included in those discussions. And so, therefore, I voted no on the bill on the Senate floor because it did not include some of the things that the task force felt were important. I was appointed to that task force by the governor, along with, let me read to you who was on the task force, Mr. John Tess, who is to my far right, representing the Oregon Historic Property Owners Association, Greg Thummel from the Oregon Department of Revenue, myself, Representative Brian Clem, Mary Ogers, the First Lady, representing the National Trust for Historic Preservation, Mr. Roper sitting to my immediate right, representing the Oregon State Historic Preservation Office, Dr. Stephen Poyser from Oregon City, representing the Oregon Preservation Alliance, Mark Edlin from Portland, representing the development community within an urban population, Barbara Sidway from Baker City, representing the development community within a rural population. If you've ever been to Baker City, the Geyser Grand Hotel, that is a beautiful piece of work that Ms. Sidway undertook and renovated. Ron Northcraft from Douglas County Assessor's Office, representing the Assessor's Association. Nicholas Sterin with the Portland Bureau of Planning, representing the League of Oregon Cities. Ann Catlin from Albany, representing homeowners who participate in the special assessment of historic properties. And Ann is here to testify today. The only individual from this list that participated in these special little work groups was Mr. Roper, and I think occasionally the Department of Revenue was asked for information. So that puts Mr. Roper in a very difficult spot. He was a member of the task force, yet he's also director of the program, the SHPO program. The task force met after the amendments were adopted and the bill left committee, and they did not endorse the bill as amended by the Senate committee.
I'm sorry, who did not endorse
it? The task force.
Thank you.
We had a meeting by telephone. We took a vote. We did not support the amendments. So what we have done is drafted the amendments that we believe are necessary for this bill, and we have two sets of amendments. And I'll tell you why we have two sets. The Dash 7 amendment, as Senator Devlin indicated, includes everything we want in the Dash 8, but it also includes the Measure 50 fix, which you'll see in Section 14. And I'm going to have Mr. Roper explain the Measure 50 fix, whether he wants to or not, because he needs to do that.
Yeah.
And he's doing it at my request and as a director of the program. The task force took a neutral position on the Dash 7 amendments with the Measure 50 fix, because we know that one may be a difficult one for us to get back across on the Senate side. So the Dash 8s are the task force-endorsed amendments, and we'll actually have Mr. Tess go through those, and Mr. Roper can go through the bill. But our task force was charged with solving the Measure 50 problem for these properties. We were charged with addressing the inequities in the program generally and making it more accountable. And this came about because of a bill I passed in the last session for 16, I think it was, Mr. Roper. How quickly we forget. Yes, Senate Bill 416, because I felt that there was not enough accountability in the historic preservation program. So that's why I got stuck on the task force. So for 18 months, our task force met many times, sometimes in person, sometimes by telephone when we all couldn't get together. We spend hours and hours hearing testimony, inviting in specialists to talk to us about this, and we get to the Senate, and it just appeared that that didn't matter. And it is unfortunate that you are not hearing this bill until June 19th, and we are expected to get out of this building next week.
Well, and if I may interrupt, this will be our hearing today. We expect to work the bill this morning if that's possible. I don't anticipate that we're going to have another meeting of this committee. So what I would really like, and I'm sorry to be saying this in the middle of your testimony, but I really need to keep things as brief as we can, get to the issues, get everybody heard, and hopefully work the bill this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's what I'm apologizing to you about. It's unfortunate that we are down to one hearing, and you will not get the benefit of the extended hearing. We did do the whole dog and pony show, if you would like, in the Senate. We had people from all over the state come in and testify about the value of this program. This program is extremely valuable. We have saved a number of properties here, and I believe we have brought tremendous accountability into this program. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to whomever you would like to hear from next. Mr. Roper can give you the details of the bill. You can probe him about Measure 50, and then Mr. Tess, who is chairman of our task force, can give you his testimony.
Thank you, and I think that's a great idea. Are there questions right now for Senator Walker, or can we go right to Mr. Roper to hear the details? Thank you. What would be, I think, very useful for the committee is to go over the details of the bill as they came from the Senate, and then the changes that are proposed in the Dash 8 amendment, and then finally the issue that was raised by Senator Devlin, which I understand is the difference between the 8s and the 7s.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Roger Roper, Assistant Director for Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. And the handout I'll be speaking from is the yellow sheet, the two-page, actually a four-page, double-sided. And I want to give you just a very brief background into the program as well. So,
please, that would be excellent.
Yeah, so this is a program that's been around since 1975, and it offers freezing of assessed value of a property. Really, it works best if you have a derelict historic building. You freeze that value. You make all these improvements to it. You make the building functional, but then you don't pay taxes on those improvements for a 15-year period. That's the way the program has run since 1975. Our office has administered the program since its inception. Benefit is available only to properties that are listed in the National Register of Historic Places, but it doesn't come automatically. Owners have to get listed in the register, then they have to step forward and make application for this benefit. Most do not. In fact, over the years, it's only been about 20% of the properties have participated in the program, of those that would have been eligible. Since 1996, property owners have had to commit to a preservation plan. So before they even get in the door, they have to have a outline the work they're going to do. It has to meet certain standards, and they have to commit to some reporting requirements along with that. If they don't follow through, they can be disqualified from the program. They'd have to pay the back taxes, penalty, and interest. So there is some recapture provisions there. So how many buildings are we talking about in this program? As of July 1st this year, we'll have about 539 properties. We're losing 250 properties this year, so the big balloon of participation has already happened. Before Measure 50, when property taxes were so uncertain, we had a lot more applications. We had 82 per year on average before the mid-90s. Since the mid-90s, we've had an average of about 37. So it has declined in its participation over the past 15 years. The makeup of these properties, about 50-50 commercial and residential. So we're seeing downtown revitalization, commercial improvements, stimulation of business, but we're also seeing neighborhood revitalization, and we're seeing urban and rural. So it really covers the state pretty well, and we've seen a lot of really exciting and heartwarming projects around the state. Multnomah County has about 40% of the properties participating in the program, as you might expect, being the largest. Those are the largest dollar amount, too, and they constitute about 60% of the dollar amount we're talking about with this benefit. In terms of reinvestment, this is a question. Are people getting in the program and doing anything with their building, or are they just taking advantage of some sweet tax break? Well, when we ran the numbers from the past 5 years, rather, commercial properties were investing on average $1.3 million when they got in the program. Residential was $105,000 per building. So that's a pretty good reinvestment we're getting. Not every property is doing that, but all of them are doing something. But on average, it's a pretty significant reinvestment. People get in this only because they think they're going to be increasing the value quite a bit, and therefore the tax savings will be meaningful to them. So that's a brief summary of the program as it currently stands. Let me just hit a few highlights of what the A engrossed version will change, and then I can go through section by section in the bill just to acquaint you with the lay of the land in what's a very lengthy and complex bill. So if we go back to page one of my handout, the key provisions of this version, one, it reduces the term of the special assessment from 15 years to 10, so almost a one-third reduction in the benefit. It also extends the sunset date. That's one of the reasons this task force was formed, is because the bill is due to sunset in 2010. This extends it out to 2020. As Senator Walker mentioned, this version also increases the accountability. That's something that's been of concern to people over the years. And so one of the main requirements is that owners must invest at least 10% of the value of their property. And as I mentioned earlier, we're seeing already a pretty significant reinvestment. Residential properties on average 105,000, commercial 1.3 million. So within the first 5 years, they've got to prove up on that preservation plan. And if they don't, then they're subject to disqualification. They continue to have to submit their reports every 3 years showing what they're up to, what they've accomplished. And we've also made a requirement so that instead of them coming to us in Salem every time they want to make a repair on their home, if they're already getting approval through a local landmark commission, we've allowed that to count for their approval. And it's a way of streamlining this process so they don't have to go to two levels of government to get the go-ahead. So we think that's a positive thing.
Are there local landmark commissions everywhere?
Not everywhere.
And some of it you'll still have to do.
Yes. Or if a city decides they don't want to do that, then we would continue that role. And property owners are also required to carry property insurance. Another important thing this bill does is it eliminates the annual open house requirement. if you were in the program 4 hours a year on a given day, you had to open it up to the public. There were concerns about property risk and personal safety because of that. But the reality is many of these properties are open already to the public. All of the commercial properties are. Many of the neighborhood groups, if they're historic districts, they conduct open houses as part of a public education or fundraising effort. So the public can enjoy this these historic buildings maybe without this requirement being in there. We've reduced the application fee substantially. That fee had been created and modified over the years, and it crept up and up, and it was seen to be an obstacle to participation. So we found a way to reduce it by about 75%. So we're hoping that that will entice people to step forward a little more. One of the main problems we've had with this, and it was an inadvertent problem, and was that if you some of the condominium properties were receiving an unintentionally generous benefit, just the way things were calculated, and so we've created a way to fix that problem so that they're paying a more fair share. And just a quick summary of that: if in the past, the way it is now, if you have a single building that gets carved up into condominiums, as a condo owner, you would only pay your share of that whole building as opposed to anything based on the value of your unit. That's the way we're changing it now, is that the unit gets looked at in its value and your benefit is calculated from that. So it's a much more fair way of doing it for the counties and for everyone involved, we think. This bill also puts a little more focus on the exterior of the buildings and worries less about a lot of the generic interior features that were really an impediment to people getting involved if they had to account for every time they changed a doorknob or put in a new sink or something. So we've tried to put emphasis on the things that matter most, and those are primarily the exterior features. And we made other streamlining improvements to the process that we think will make the program just work better. It's 35 years old and is due for a little bit of an overhaul, and this bill does that. Any questions offhand on those key points?
Go ahead.
If not, then let's march through the bill. And I've tried to create a little cheat sheet for you. So on pages 3 and 4 of the handout, it goes through each section and gives you a little bit of information about it. And I can also refer to which page number in the bill. Section 1 is a preamble to the statute, and it's been with this program for a long time, and it's a lot of highfalutin language, but it's actually pretty important in terms of setting out the philosophy of what this program is all about, in terms of preserving historic buildings in Oregon that have cultural meaning, have artistic meaning, and are just part of our irreplaceable heritage. So we felt that was important to keep in the bill. Section 2, moving on, has all the definitions that we use here. What's the definition of a historic property? What's the definition of the historic rehabilitation standards? All of those things are laid out in Section 2, and we haven't changed those very much. Section 3 goes through the application process. And, of course, this bill doesn't cover the entire program. These are only the aspects of the program that are being either changed or even slightly tweaked. The application process is much the same as it has been in terms of the owner having to submit that preservation plan that meets the standards. And that's where we have a nice little negotiation and a little education with the property owner, where they can come in with some ideas of what they want to do, and then we have to work that, massage that a bit so it meets the standards. And in the end, we come up with really sort of an agreement that lays out the game plan for the term of their benefit. So if you look on page 4 under 2A near the top, we talked about this 10% spending requirement that's a new element. So when they come in with their preservation plan, they have to be able to demonstrate that they're doing enough that would at least meet 10% of the real market value of that property. And we've acknowledged that a lot of these people come in and they're doing sweat equity, so they're not going to have hard dollars, and so there is a way for us to account for sweat equity, and the Senate made that clear in the motion on the A engrossed version, that sweat equity was an intended part of meeting this 10% spending requirement. On line 16 of page 4, we talk about the 0.1% of the value being the what the fee is based on. So we reduced that, again, 75% of what it had been. Moving on.
So I'm sorry, what was the fee before?
It was 0.1% of the real market value. Now it's 0.1% of the assessed value.
I see. And this is what you run your office on? Or what is it used for?
Over the years, it's been used for a variety of things. Sometimes it's been used for staff, but increasingly it moved away from that and tried to get more toward the intent of what that account was set up for, and it was to benefit historic buildings around the state. So it would be used for grants, public education programs, things like that. And actually with the intent of perhaps acquiring historic properties that may be threatened or derelict and then turning those around. So.
And whose idea was it to lower the fee?
I think it was pretty universal.
Okay.
The task force.
Task force, thank you.
The agency, but also participants. So, okay, moving on to section 4. 4 and 5 deal with the actual certification. So the applicants submit their application. We go through it as an agency and make sure everything's square. We send it out to the local government. We send it out to the county assessor. They look it over, make sure it's there, and this will be important in terms of examining and proving up on this 10% spending requirement. If the county says this doesn't look like it meets that requirement, then we start to have a more of a negotiation. So sharing that application with the local government and the county assessor we think is a healthy process, and that's happening now as well. We'll also be providing the owner with a plaque that goes on the front of the building that lets people know that this property is participating in the program. And that's a slight change. We're paying for that plaque now instead of turning around and dinging the property owner to pony up for that separately. Section 6 and 7 deal with reporting requirements of the applicants. As we've talked about, they have to submit a written report every third year to our office, citing their progress, and if they're not making progress, then we get back with them and find out why, and sometimes there are legitimate reasons, sometimes not, and they may go on notice as being on probation almost for being disqualified from the program if they're not following through. By the fifth year, they have to, if they haven't already, they have to let us know that they have met that 10% spending requirement. So that's a new provision. A very important part, if you look on page 8, line 18, not only have they had to have a plan in place that we approve, but any time they actually get around to starting a project, they're going to repair that porch or they're going to do something with those windows, they need to get approval. And it's either from our office or from the local landmark commission. And there's some things the local landmark commissions don't have authority to review that they may have to come to us for, interior features primarily. So we'll still have a role in it. And our office will still have a commenting role, even on that local government review. So we'll have 14 days before the local government makes its decision, that local landmark commission, and we can weigh in on an issue. And we actually see it as a way to provide some training for those local landmark commissions and get some more consistent and rulings from around the state so everybody's a little more on the same page in how we look at this thing. And then on line 31 of page 8, of course, all work has to meet the historic rehabilitation standards, and those are spelled out, and those have been very consistent over the years. So we feel that that's a very good benchmark for making sure the right things are being done to these buildings.
And this bill doesn't change those standards.
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
Yeah, those stay the same. Nor does this bill change the way the benefit is calculated. And it's very complex. To say that it's just a freeze of property tax is really a gross oversimplification of it. And without making it going into the formula too much, because I need a slide rule to do it almost, the way it's being calculated is virtually the same as it has been. And we feel that it's not an overly generous benefit. Given the participation rate over the last 15 years, 37 properties per year on average coming on board, there's not a big rush for folks to come in and take advantage of something they're not entitled to. Okay, moving on to, section 9. deals with disqualification. And disqualification sounds like a punitive action, but it's not really. It can be simply your term expires. That's disqualification from special assessment. And that's language that's consistent in state statute regarding special assessment programs, other types of special assessment programs. But there are other ways that you would be disqualified that are more punitive, and those are addressed on page 10, beginning on line 36. So if the owner makes inappropriate changes to the building, or if there are if there's a fire, storm damage, whatever, that destroys the building, that would be a cause for disqualification. Or if an owner, like on line 39, if an owner simply says, I've had enough, I don't want to participate anymore, they can opt out. They would have to pay the back taxes and a penalty, but they can choose to remove themselves from the scrutiny of the program that they've signed up for. And that's happened over the years, sometimes with the second owner who bought the property but was not the initial one to sign up. Owner, they can also be disqualified if they don't submit their reports and keep us informed of what they're doing. Of course, if they demolish the property, make other changes, or fail to keep up their property insurance. So we don't see that many disqualifications, except most of them are more on the voluntary basis from the property owners. Mostly the program works pretty well. People follow through on what they're supposed to do. So this has not been very burdensome, and we're not adding anything that new here, just more clarification and tweaking. Section 10 gets into the penalty, calculating that amount, you know, 15% of the amount that they, in addition to what they would have paid. Moving on to section 11, this gets into second terms. So you complete your first term. And if you want to come back for a second term, first you have to demonstrate that you're going to do some additional work. You also get reassessed in between there, so you're not carrying forward that initial property tax freeze. You're getting a new snapshot of value and getting in for a second term, but only if you're showing that you're doing some substantial work. And the way this A engrossed version reads, you'd again have to meet that 10% spending requirement. You'd also have to do work that either promotes compliance with ADA, seismic improvements, or energy or sustainability improvements. So these are it's a more refined, targeted work plan that would be needed for this second term. And right now, I think it's only about 20% of the first term applicants turn around and have gone for a second term. Okay, moving on to section 12. This deals with local government. Involvement here, and this is changing this slightly in terms of a local option for local governments for those second terms. This has bounced around a little bit over the last couple of sessions, whether a property owner could come forward. Right now, the way this one reads is that for commercial properties, they could qualify for a second term if they meet those requirements of spending the 10%, doing the ADA or the seismic or whatever. Residential properties, though, a city could say, you know, we just don't like the idea of second term for residential, and they could opt to disallow that within their community. What's happened, though, when it was the other way around, where they had to opt in, most communities were opting in, and it was just an extra step for them. So there were very few that had stepped forward to say we're adamantly opposed to that. Most of them, if someone in their community wanted a second term, they were more than willing to pass the resolution. So we this was changed a little just to reflect that reality. Section 13. The main components here are on page 15. And this has to do with additions to properties. And it gets complicated if you're adding on to a building. Should that addition qualify as part of this property tax benefit, or should it be taxed separately? And who goes out with the tape measure to figure out the distinction there? In the end, it seemed like a simpler approach to say if additions are made to a building, they have to meet those rehabilitation standards. If they don't, then the whole property gets thrown off the program. But if they do meet those standards, which means they can't be overwhelming additions, they have to be very appropriate and subordinate, then, and they're making the building more functional, let's recognize that, and the whole property gets the special assessment benefit rather than trying to parse it out. So that's what happens. That's one of the changes that's happened under this section. And those are addressed mostly from lines 11 through 26 on page 15. Another very important section on this page begins with line 34 that starts talking about condominiums and how we fix that condominium problem. So the way it works, if you're a developer, you turn an old warehouse building into 20 condos. When you sell the condo, that condo gets reassessed at its market value, what the new owner bought it for, say, and the benefit for that owner gets calculated on that unit. And so each unit gets its benefit calculated when it's first sold by the developer to the first buyer. And this is something that we've worked on with a variety of folks to make sure that it's workable, and it seems to be the right fix for this problem.
And Mr. Chair, that came from the task force. That was one of our charges, and we delivered.
Section 14, just some little technical corrections, nothing we need to dwell on. Section 15 expands the appeals committee from 3 to 5 members, and we've changed the way the appeal works. So if you're a property owner and you don't like what we say, that your project didn't meet the standards, you can appeal to this committee, and it would be a 5-member committee made up of folks representing different interests. And that would be the first line of appeal. Then it would go to a hearings officer after that. Right now that is reversed, and it's an awkward process, but not very many people go through it, so it hasn't been a big problem. But this simply improves on that appeals process, we think. Okay, moving on into the home stretch. Thank you for your patience.
Mr. Chair, do you see why it took us 18 months to resolve this issue, these issues that are presented in this bill? It's a very complex program.
Section 16, again, some technical corrections, just, you know, whether you can get other special assessments in tandem with this one. Section 17, rulemaking issues, again, just technical things. Section 18, the key element there is on line 24 of page 17. That extends the sunset from 2010 to 2020. Section 19 eliminates this requirement that they notify us on sale of a property. We found that was not needed. And Section 21...
Excuse me, how does it do that?
It's very subtle in here.
I'm looking for italics and I'm not seeing them.
Let me see here.
Oh, I do find it on the last page, ending on line 18. I'm not sure exactly where it starts.
Right. Yeah, it is very subtle, and that actually starts way back, I believe. This is one of those very technical things that we actually didn't spend a lot of time with. So,
I have a strange brain, and I tend to pick on the pieces that other people don't want to look at.
This dips back into another statute.
I'll figure it out
too,
later.
So.
I'll figure it out later. Thank
okay.
you. Go ahead.
All right. And Section 20 just repeals some of the redundant and unnecessary sections of the existing statute. Again, this statute had been around for 35 years. It had been layered with a lot of things, and a lot of redundancies have crept in, so this cleans those up. Section 22 simply removes all the captions in the A engrossed version that we needed just to guide our way through here. And then Section 23 says that this will take effect on the 91st day after signee die. So that's a summary of the engrossed. And
You and I have been sort of discussing this as we go, but I wonder if there are other questions about the bill before we go on. All right. But if there are, as they come up, please ask them. Go ahead, Dan. You want to talk about the amendments, I think.
I will. I'll primarily address the issue Senator Walker brought up in terms of the Measure 50 fix and how that was resolved.
Okay.
And Senator Devlin explained that, how some property owners, when they come off, they get a new snapshot of value, and they're way over what they would have been. Nobody wanted that to happen. I should mention that there are other property owners who come off, and because the way this is calculated, and this is a calculation we can't get at. This is a constitutional sort of thing. Some property owners come off, and they're better off than they would have been had they never participated, and others are about the same. So it's all over the map. But those that are harmed are really harmed, and it just seemed wrong that should be the case for someone who's willingly stepped forward and said, we want to do the right thing with our historic building. But so the way that was resolved, and this took a lot of thinking through and checking with folks at revenue and checking with people with legislative counsel, is that if you come off your term and you find out that you're going to be harmed.
Could you refer us to the section in the amendment?
I believe it was section 14 in the -7 amendment. Senator Walker has that here.
It's on page 25.
Yes.
Thank you.
And then it goes over to 26 and 27. The simple explanation for this is that they would get a much lesser benefit. They could go for a period of extended term, of indefinite period, with a much lesser benefit that essentially gets them down to where they would have been had they not participated in the program. It's not a really elegant fix, but it was the only constitutional fix that we could find. We went down many dead-end roads in trying to find a way to get through this. So they're still in special assessment. So they're really not getting out and not triggering that same reassessment of value as if they were being disqualified from the program outright. This would keep that value back at something more in line with where they would have been. We know that's not a precise factor. What if you've added onto a property? How much did that add to the value? When did you add it? The first year, the 10th year? There are some complications with how that would be calculated, but again, this was the best solution that could be reached in trying to resolve this issue. And what we expect actually would happen over time is that a property owner would be on this for a while, but then they would find a chance where they could merge back in, maybe when the market goes down or some other reason, or a change in ownership, and a new owner didn't have that same expectation of those very low taxes. And so we didn't expect that there would be a lot of people getting into this extended period and just camping out for years and years, because they would have to stay under design review approval for everything they did. So that's an incentive for them to want to get out, because they don't want to have to be answering to our office or the local government in quite the same way.
And Mr. Chair, if I might add, this was difficult coming up with this fix, because everything else that we tried, we ran into constitutional issues. So this is the only one that worked. On the bottom of page 5 in subsection 2A, it indicates that an application for extended special assessment must be made pursuant to ORS, blah, 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 and a fee payable to the county assessor. It was determined that if we were going to allow this extended period of special assessment, because of the complicating computation of numbers and whatnot, that the county assessor should be able to charge a fee for that. And so that's why that provision was included in this section.
I'm sorry, would you show us where that is again?
It's at the bottom of page, we're on the -7 amendment, bottom of page 25, line
25.
30. Yes, line 30, and on to the next page through line 4. Talks about the fee.
Thank you. I misheard you. I thought you said page 5, so I'm looking in another place. Thank you.
I didn't enunciate. Sorry.
That's fine.
And that is the that is why we put that in the -7. The -7 includes all of our changes plus this, so you can make that decision whether to move on that. And as Mr. Roper has laid out, there much of what the task force wanted is in the final bill. However, Mr. Tess will tell you what we would like changed that would be more reflective of what this task force worked on and what we agreed to and what we think would be most beneficial for the program.
Did the task force work on this Measure 50 piece?
Yes. We are the ones who came up with the extended special assessment.
I see. So the task force is the one that went through all the dead ends in order to get to this solution.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and that's why I say 18 months, we went through many, many dead ends. We went around and around and around in circles on many issues that you find in this bill, and I think we've done an excellent job of plowing through that. Sometimes it's very tedious.
Thank you. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Am I understanding correctly that the task force is neutral on the A7s and has endorsed the A8s? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, that is exactly correct. We just felt we couldn't endorse. There was a motion made to not support the -7. That failed, so I made a motion to be neutral, and that motion passed because we're just concerned about, we don't want the bill to fail, and we've had enough difficulties this session. So we would just like to at least get these small changes we would like. I think there are many of us who believe the Measure 56 is valuable, the Measure 50 fix is valuable, but it's really up to you whether you want to step out and do that. And Senator Devlin certainly gave you the very compelling reason why with one of his constituents. Senator Metzger also has a constituent with a similar problem.
Please.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure that I'm understanding the distinction correctly. Is it correct to say that the neutral position of the task force on the A7 is a process consideration as opposed to a concern with the policy that is embodied in the Measure 50 fix in the A7? Is that a correct statement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, I think that's a correct statement. I think they just were concerned about losing their bill.
Thank you.
And the bill as it came from the Senate, the bill as it came from the Senate, does that embody? I'll wait.
I'm sorry.
Does that embody most of what the task force asked for? I understand there's a difference in the term, but other than that, and maybe a couple technical changes, and this Measure 50 piece, is it essentially the same as what the task force came up with, or is it a radical departure?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I missed some of that. You mean the entire bill?
The bill as it came from the Senate.
Okay. Well, I can, there are, the sweat equity piece
mm-hmm.
is new.
Okay.
That came from Senator Burdick. That was not.
Did the task force object to that?
The task force objects to the way it was calculated, and we have a fix for that in the -8.
Okay.
Senator Burdick changed the term of the program to 10 years instead of 15. The task force does not believe that is appropriate, and there'll be testimony as to why. We're okay with the second term being 10 years, but the first term must be 15, and it was changed to 10. That was not what we requested. And the minimum investment, the 10% investment, that was new, and the task force would prefer that be calculated on the real market value. Am I correct, Mr. Tess?
What it is for the second year. We're
talking you have about to identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. John Tess, chairman of the task force, President of Heritage Investment Corporation. With respect to that, the minimum investment, we do not have a problem with the minimum investment in the first term of the special assessment, but for the second term, we do have an issue with it because in many instances, people will not be able to meet that spending requirement. And the second 15 years was intended to address specific issues that had to do with ADA, seismic, and energy upgrades. And we, in fact, added energy and seismic and sustainability issues to that. These are some of the issues that quite often become the reasons for people tearing down historic buildings. And so it's very important that people be able to meet those things. And if you have the 10% in there, it doesn't happen. The other thing is that that's the way it's been working, in the past for the second 15 years. The SHPO has always made the determination and have looked at the programs and determined whether or not it was a substantial investment, and it warranted having a second 10 years, and we feel that the Chippewa office has done a good job in administering the program, and they should continue to be able to do that. But I had sat on a governor's task, seismic task force, that second 15 years was specifically came out of that other task force to what do we do with this ADA seismic and this energy conservation stuff, because what was happening is a lot of buildings, while the law initially acted to deterrent demolition, after people got off, they were finding that demo was going to occur. This stopped that demolition in many cases. Thank you.
Other than that, Mr. Chair, the bill is as reflected from the task force and all of our hard work.
Thank you.
That's very helpful. Did you? Are there other questions? Did you have additional remarks you wanted to make?
I think just a few.
And I need to keep you short. Keep it short so we can actually hear from the other people before we have to move on.
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
Of
I appreciate
committee.
That.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I stated who I was, and again, John Tess. I just want to make a couple things clear here. Roger had said that the important part of the law was in the preamble, and I think that that's a key part. It says the Legislative Assembly hereby declares as in the best interest of the state to maintain, preserve, and rehabilitate properties of Oregon historical significance. Historic preservation incentive programs provide a public benefit by encouraging preservation and appropriate rehabilitation of significant properties. What happens with, and we thank the Senate for getting the bill out and getting it over here to the House, what that bill does, though, is it eliminates the mandate to preserve and to maintain, and that's one of the most important things. Sometimes in historic preservation, it's better to do nothing and let someone else do something, or to make sure that it's done right, and that's what this law has done. When you have the review by the State Historic Preservation Office, who has a group of professionals that look at these things, or by the locals, yeah, you don't get cheap windows going into buildings. You don't get cheap roofs and things like that. So it's very important that that these dash 8s be put in place. Also, I've included in your packet, the great thing about historic preservation about this law is that you can see success stories. I've included 8 pictures in here, and you can see the pretty pictures of, you know, of all the different projects that have happened. A lot of these are centered in Portland, because I am from Multnomah County. I have one there of the Embry Farmstead, though. Throughout the state, you can just look at these things, and it does have a ripple effect. In all the arguments about this law, about is it too much or what does it do, no one ever takes into effect what the ripple effect of this law is and all of the other things that have occurred as a result. For example, in Portland, you have in the Pearl District, you have 6,000 new housing units. You have hundreds of thousands of new retail space and commercial space, and all that goes on to the tax rolls. And that, in smaller communities, that happens also. The thing that's important about the Dash 8s is it really addresses the small communities and lets the small communities throughout the state use these programs. They're the ones who always get cheated in these programs, is because we're looking at, you know, the big property owners can do these things. This program does work for small properties and smaller communities. Finally, this thing creates jobs in a time that we should be creating jobs and we need jobs. It's been proven time and time again. There's a million reports that tell you that historic preservation is much more labor intensive and what it does in terms of helping the economy. And the changes that were made here, these are not changes that we just looked at after 30 years. This is a culmination. I've been involved with this program. I used to administer the program in 1975. This thing has been looked at in almost every legislative session. And, you know, most recently in 1992 with the governor's task force. So this law, not only was it looked at in depth under a microscope this time, we met over 30 times as a committee and many more times, you know, just individually. Roger and I know each other very well now, and so it's Senator Walker and I. But, and other members of the committee, but this is not something that's thought of lightly, and it is something that's good for the state. And with that, I'll move on, because I know there's other people that need to testify.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one or two, if I may. I would like to know in the past 2 years how many properties have come on in say last year and this year.
In In the most recent year, we only had 14 properties come on board. And so when the economy's bad, this program goes down, and when it's good, it goes up some. The year prior to that, we had 44 projects.
Was that 07?
Yes. Well, 07 applications for the 08 tax year. So, yes.
So 14 is this year?
For the 09 tax. For
right.
Yeah. It's 14, 44, then going back another year, 69. And again, you can see the economy reflecting that same trend.
And you talked about disqualification. How many properties do you typically disqualify, and why do they get disqualified?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, we have very few disqualifications during the year. Most of those that may come forward, and it may just be a handful a year, two, five, are more voluntary, where the owner just says, we're ready to get out. We've decided we need to build something bigger here, do something different with the property. Every once in a while, we have to go in and make a disqualification, and in this past year, we've had, I believe, one.
So the five-year is a one-way commitment. The homeowner doesn't commit for the 5 years, or 15 years, rather. It's only we commit for 15 years. Is that right?
Mr. Chair,
it's voluntary. They get out of it.
If they get out, then they have to pay back the taxes they would have paid.
All the way
plus,
back
right.
Plus a penalty.
Plus a penalty.
Okay.
And interest.
Yeah. Okay. That answered that question. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony and your help with this bill this morning.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, if you need Alan Dale from Legislative Council to explain anything, he knows this bill very well.
Thank you. let's get the next panel, Philip Kennedy Wong, David Barenberg, Doris Penwell, Michael Novak.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Michael Novak with the League of Oregon Cities. I certainly want to thank the Task Force on Historic Properties and all the preservation, all the work that they did. The League wants to let you know that we support the continuation of the Historic Properties Program. We recognize the benefits that historic preservation brings to communities and cities. As Mr. Test mentioned, the benefits to the local economies, the projects for investment and surrounding properties, tourism, community events take place, construction jobs, and certainly the community sense of pride. And just to keep it short, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, I'm Dave Barenberg representing the city of Portland. And as you've heard, Portland has about 40% of the historic properties that are in the program. Currently, there are 293 properties in the program in the city of Portland. 14 entered last year, 29 the year before, and we're anticipating that 50 will come off the rolls this year, having cycled through. On average, we have about the 15-year average was 19 properties per year coming on to the rolls. We think that this program is really vitally important to maintaining the sense of place and character and historical traditions of the city. It also has been an engine for economic development, I think, as Mr. Tessa said, spurring millions and millions of dollars in investments in historic properties, which then have leveraged millions and tens of millions of dollars in investments in the community, in the areas that surround these historic properties. So it is one that we found to be very beneficial for the city. We are vitally interested in this program being renewed and making jumping the remaining hurdles to being renewed this session so it won't expire in 2010. We very much appreciate the work of the task force. We had a member of our city planning bureau participating, representing the League of Oregon Cities and cities in general, so we've been involved very deeply. deeply with the task force and appreciate the work of Senator Walker. We appreciate the work of Senator Burdick, who had many questions and wanted to make sure that the tax benefits were justified in this economy, and put some sideboards that you see in Senate Bill 192, and I think were explained by the previous panel. So we are urging your advancing a bill to the floor, and look forward to answering any questions that you may have regarding our participation.
Thank you. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doris Penwell. I represent the Association of Oregon Counties. As with the cities, we're very supportive of this program, and because it's sunsetting in 2010, there was a required review, as you have heard. The task force did some great work. They definitely came up with what we believe mostly is contained in the 192A bill that you have before us. When Senator Burdick did have the question, she asked for a group of representatives from the cities, the counties, Multnomah County, City of Portland, the Assessors Association, and help as needed to even understand the program from the Department of Revenue. So we worked together with her and tried to keep Senator Walker informed of the process we were going through. Frankly, we were probably going through the same process the task force did to even understand how the benefit was figured. So we learned a lot through this process, and we feel very confident that the program is on good footing and can move ahead. We understand there are some issues still remaining. They don't occur immediately, probably, and we'd be very glad to continue to work with whomever needs to reconvene us to see if there are ever any special things that need to be handled as the new program starts. So we're very fortunate to have been involved, and we think the bill before us does most of what we needed to do. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. For the record, Phil Kennedy, Wong, Multnomah County. I'd like to state for the record that the county supports the engrossed version of the bill, and we appreciate the work that the Senate Revenue Committee has put into it, and also members of the task force and other stakeholders, including those that you see today at this table. I just want to start with just giving you the context of Multnomah County's interest in this program, and why initially when this bill was put forward, we had some general concerns. So let me start with a few quick facts. About 80% of the properties participating in this program are from Multnomah County. And let me give you a rundown of how it breaks down in different types of properties. So we have a total of 1,809 properties that's participating in this program within Multnomah County. Roughly 1,600 are residential, 174 is commercial, and about 3 are industrial, and 32 are multifamily properties. And the estimated revenue in terms of lost revenue for Multnomah County and all the taxing districts within Multnomah County, which includes schools, roughly equates annually in 2008 $13 million. So let me put that in context in terms of Multnomah County's budget and what it means in terms of the services that we provide. The county roughly has a $300 million plus, probably roughly $325 million general fund. And essentially, a $13 million loss from that can be quite significant. So when this bill was brought forward, naturally we had some concerns, because what it means for us is, you know, this is the revenue for public safety, such as jails, human services, and other important services that the county provides. At the same time, we also recognize the value that this program represents to our community, to our city, to our residents, and to our businesses on a number of levels, from preserving the heritage that our cities and our communities want to continue, to also some of the economic opportunities in revitalizing neighborhoods and being able to maintain some of the historic features to that. So with that said, we would encourage this committee to adopt the engrossed version of the bill. And like my colleagues here, we also recognize there's further work to be done in refining this program. Certainly when we came to the table earlier in the session, there were a lot of things that we wanted to bring to the program that we thought that would give greater specification and clarity and also stronger sideboards in terms of ensuring that this program isn't misused at all. And obviously we didn't get everything that we want, but we certainly don't want to stand in the way with this bill moving forward because we believe it is a very important program. It is about to sunset and we want to see it continue. So with that, thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kenny Wong, I heard you talk a little bit about the other services that the county provides, including, I believe you mentioned public safety and jails. I'm flipping through the photos of the success stories that were handed out earlier, and I'm obviously struck particularly by Grand Central Market, which is in my district. And as you may or may not know, that in its prior incarnation was a haven for gang activity and dealers of crack cocaine. So, and obviously is much better now. Would you say that this program has an impact on reducing the amount that you have to spend on public safety and jails by revitalizing neighborhood?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Bailey, that's a very difficult question to answer because that's one of the challenges, I think, in terms of any public policy matter is how do you measure the benefits of this program? And, you know, I think the intended purpose of the program, the way that I understand it, is to preserve historic properties. Whether or not if there are additional benefits such as through the revitalization, you know, the result would be, you know, less crime or less antisocial behavior. You know, that's a question I'm not prepared to answer.
Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We very much appreciate your testimony and all the work that that testimony represents. Anne Caitlin.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the Revenue Committee. My name is Ann Catlin, and I'm here on behalf of historic property owners in Albany and other middle and small towns not represented here today. I'd like to express my support for Senate Bill 192A with the Dash 8 or other amendments. As a City of Albany's preservation planner and residential historic property owner, I see and hear firsthand numerous times in one day often, how important this incentive program is to encouraging buyers to first purchase a property and second, actually take on the restoration. This restoration of the built environment is an essential part of Oregon's history and Main Street beginnings and futures. I was appointed to serve on the Governor's Task Force, and we did meet for a long time discussing these issues at length, as you've heard, and we do feel that we came up with solutions that fix the shortcomings and improve the program's effectiveness as a preservation and revitalization tool, especially for your small towns and rural communities. We are pleased that the bill is here before you today, but we do recommend that you consider amendments to it. I'd like to make a few points on the importance of the program as well as considering some of the amendments as proposed in the Dash 8 and possibly Dash 7. The 15-year incentive is needed to entice most of us to take that leap of faith to purchase and restore a building in disrepair or neglect that is subject to historic review and that, in smaller communities, often has lower property values and commercial rents. It is challenging to make the restoration pencil or even get off the ground, as many communities do not have other financial incentive programs for commercial properties, and there is little to no help for residential owners. In areas with lower property values, the calculated benefit may often be substantially smaller. Betty Tam of Roseburg made this critical point in testimony to the Senate committee back 2 months ago in April. In rural communities, the towns and developers are often not as experienced or sophisticated as large urban entities. So if the hoops are too large or too complex, it just won't happen. Preservation efforts are making a big difference in our communities. Incentives are critical to attracting someone to take on a large project, especially in your smaller communities, before a building is lost or becomes even more challenging and expensive to repair. This bill is, with amendments, is revenue neutral. That was our assessment from the task force. I wanted to say that before I forgot. And it has caused tremendous amounts of investment that truly offset the small loss in tax revenue throughout the state. And the ripple effect is very huge in an old neighborhood or even just one block in a small downtown, both visually and economically, and jump-starting other preservation projects. A mixed-use restoration project brought $7.5 million outside dollars into North Bend. It is estimated that the building restoration supported 100 local jobs for 16 months, which of course is a huge job stimulus in such a small town. The project would not have proceeded without the historic tax freeze and other historic incentives. There is information on this project on the very back sheet, as well as examples from Albany that illustrate how important restoration of one building can completely change a neighborhood and start that ripple effect. And one of those houses was one of the City of Albany's favorite places for arrests and ongoing vandalism and drug deals. And I can tell you the city has spent a lot of money handling derelict properties, and preservation is working to reduce costs and get those folks out where they're really needed. While many participants invest far more than 100% of the full property value over a 15-year term, the reduced term
Ma'am, we do have your written testimony.
Okay.
If you could summarize quickly, that would be helpful, because
okay.
We are running out of time.
I might just draw your attention to some of the pictures, but I do want to clarify that the amendments do make the program attractive, and without the amendments, I do feel there will be a drop in participation in the program. And this preservation success stories are essential for small communities, and if you don't have that first one or a couple, you can really stop and halt, or sometimes even go backwards in your smaller communities and trying to do economic revitalization and downtown revitalization as well as neighborhood preservation. And with that, I will let you read the rest of my testimony, and I'll be happy to answer questions now or later. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you. Yes, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did the Pix Theater downtown in Albany take advantage? Were they able to take advantage of this program? Do you know that?
They are able and eligible. They're on the National Register. They Pix folks don't own the building, and the property owner has to take advantage of it, and Randy Tripp has not been interested in any incentive programs.
Okay. The only reason I asked that was that is a huge addition to downtown Albany and is helping in the revitalization that's been an ongoing goal there for, I don't know, 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Thank you. Thank you very much. And with that, that being the last person signed up, we will close the public hearing. I'm sorry?
Can I say something?
If you do it very quickly.
I will. Give me 90 seconds.
Yeah.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John McArdle. I'm the mayor of Independence. I'm also the vice chair of the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm also a historic property owner in Independence. My wife and I own the Eldridge House, the Craftsman-style home on the National Historic Registry. I just wanted to take just a very brief moment to tell you that on behalf of our community, we believe in the importance of this program and the program should be continued. It's good for Independence. We were founded in 1843, and there's a lot of history. This program has helped us continue that history throughout the community. It's assisted property owners, and when you own an old house, and I know this, there's no such thing as a cheap fix. If you... Wood windows, you can't replace them with vinyl. You know, those are expensive. And trying to do energy efficiency, I have 37 large windows, single pane, and they're 100-year-old windows. And so it's not a cheap thing. Our city council last year made a policy decision that we wanted to continue with the program in our community last year, and that was a thoughtful discussion that we had. I just want to tell you, the people love their historic. You know, we're open since we're on the program, we're open 4 hours a year, and the whole community gets together and has a tour. Some years we get, 25, 30, 70 people. One year we had 240 people come through our home and sign in 4 hours.
Thank you.
People love it.
Thank you very much. Yeah, your 90 seconds are up. Are there other any questions for the mayor? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony. All right. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 192. Colleagues, we're going to stand at ease for just a moment. We've called absent members back. And for those who are not with us all the time, recognize we're right at the end of session. So many of our members are very, very interested in this bill, but they had other things they had to do this morning, and they'll be back for their vote. We'll stand at ease.
Okay, where are we?
We're about to open a work session.
One more second.
Mike's alive. He wants to move the bill as is.
We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 192. Representative Call?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate 192 A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Call moves Senate Bill 192 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I am very disappointed that we are not going to move the A7s here. I think this is the right policy, and I think we need to respect what the task force has come up with. We recently passed a bill in this body, House Bill 2067, that requires an automatic sunset and review of tax credits for exactly this reason, that when a tax credit comes up for review at the sunset period, that we have a task force of experts that is able to review the program and make a recommendation about what the best policy is going forward. We have had a chance for people that know far more about this program than I do, and then I think many people do, to look at this and to come up with a set of recommendations. And they have made a recommendation that this bill go forward with the at least the A8 amendments. And that is something that I do not feel comfortable ignoring.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bailey. Others? Representative Call?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do share my colleagues' concerns with this bill, but to my perspective, it's not so simple as saying that we're respecting a task force process in a vacuum. To my perspective, there is a committee process that took place on the Senate side. They have sent us a bill. We're up against it at the end of session, and from my perspective, on balance, I'm going to respect the committee process that took place on the Senate side, vote yes on this, and get this bill enacted into law.
Thank you. Other comments?
Mr. Chairman, will we stand at ease for just a moment?
The committee will stand at ease. They will come back to order. Is there any further discussion? Let me simply note that we're at the end of the session. The more things that we do, the more likely it is that a bill does not get passed. It is very important, I believe, especially after the testimony we've heard today and the discussions that I've had with a number of interested parties, that we pass a bill. The bill we have that I believe we can pass is the one that the Senate sent us. And I would say that if, to the extent I have any influence over it, if there are problems with the operation of the law as reflected in that bill, we can address them at a time when we have more time to actually look at the situation. I frankly do not know whether we have to have a 15-year program or a 10-year program. I frankly do not know whether the Measure 50 fix that's been proposed in the -7s is workable, whether it's necessary, whether it's constitutional or not. I simply haven't had time to examine the issue, and I believe that's probably true of most of the rest of the committee members. This bill, as it stands with its warts and all, I think we can pass. And I think we can, in effect, extend the sunset, and we can move on it. We're in a difficult spot, but my belief is that we only have a few days left of session, and if you count the calendar, you look at second reading, third reading times, the chances of getting a bill back to the Senate for concurrence. I have been told there may be difficulty with concurrence in the Senate. Appointment of a conference committee, the workings of a conference committee, and having it all done by Thursday or Friday of next week, I think that's very, very risky.
And I hope that the committee will approve the bill, even though there are details of it that not all members like. Get it to the floor and get this piece taken care of. And then if it turns out that there are problems with it, the legislature, either in the interim, in the halfway session or later, could address those. We've addressed this issue before, when the sunset date was not upon us. Certainly, with the bill that Senator Walker referred to in 2007, there's absolutely no reason why it couldn't be done again. If it turns out that those who want the longer term are right, or if there's some other details that can be managed. Anything else, Representative Springer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be supporting the motion somewhat reluctantly. I'm not pleased or satisfied changing the term from 15 years to 10 years. I think that that's a significant piece and of great concern to me. That said, I would like to pass out something to maintain this on statute.
Yeah, and I'm really sorry that we got this so late. We did not have it in our hands until Wednesday Wednesday afternoon. So this is the earliest we could hear it under our rules. Anything else? Please call the roll. And the vote is on moving the bill to the floor with a due pass.
Representative
Bailey.
No. Representative Benz.
Yes.
Representative Berger.
No.
Representative
Boone. Aye.
Representative Gelser.
Aye.
Representative
Hall.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Representative Springer.
Aye.
Barnhart.
Aye. With that, the motion carries. The bill goes to the floor with a due pass. Is there anyone with a burning desire to carry the bill?
Mr. Chair. Ma'am, I have no burning desire, but I would like to comment on the vote.
Please do that.
I voted no with Representative Bailey because it has been my observation that if you have an R and a D voting no on a bill, everyone pays attention, and it gives a chance for a floor discussion that is very instructive to the body that there is some fundamental unhappiness with this bill. And so I joined with my colleague in order to be able to get this message to the floor.
Thank you. That's a very good message. And with that, I will carry the bill. Thank you. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 192. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3414. We're going to move it. Are we needed on the floor?
You will be.
I know that.
I need to be on the floor. I can come back.
I know that. Will you find out? I mean, if Ways and Means is meeting, they're going to have us.
Hey, Phil. Mr. Chairman. Can we have a second?
The committee will stand at ease.
Can I talk to you here for a second? Will you come with me?
Oh, yeah, sure. You want to talk to me?
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't understand.
I've already run into this week. I'm sorry.
Are we going to the floor?
No. When Reed and I went together off this committee.
Do you need me, Kevin, or you need
anyone else?
Cliff.
Yes.
Let's reconvene the committee, and Paul, you're going to describe the bill to us, and then I don't have the list. While Paul is describing the bill, could we have Jenna Ingram, Jones Oden, and Tina Greiner come up? Please, go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the House Bill 3414, you have the dash three amendments. It's a complete replacement of the bill. And what the dash three do is make a modification to the structure that was set up in 2007 about the charitable checkoff and a rotation system that was established by the 2007 legislation. If you look on the section one of the amendment, you can see that there are it refers to how entities qualify for instruction listing or listing on the form itself and through this rotation system. And if you look at under the current law language, section 1, sub 3 there, an entity must meet the qualifications described in ORS 305.720, collect 10,000 or more signatures from electors of the state, and B, which is sub A there, the Oregon Veterans Home, the Alzheimer's Disease Research Fund, Oregon Military Financial Assistance Fund, and the new language is the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association, which is, this is the purpose of the bill, is to add that organization to that list that can be members. If you look at B and C below that, shows the other ways to qualify to be a 501(c) and have at least $1 million for the year prior to the application, or be an affiliated group of nonprofits. Then the section 2 repeats the exact same language. That's because the statute is set up so there's a repeat of it in chapter 822 there, because the law changes in 2013 and that just appears as a convenience in the statute. So it just goes through the language. Sections 1 and 2 are identical, and again the point being to add the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association to that list for the charitable checkoff rotation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Jenna Ingram, Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. Yes. We are not dummies. We know that we have a very short time here, so I'll be very, very brief. But I just want to hit some high points. You have my written testimony before you. The Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association is a 501c3. They do many charitable things. They provide death benefits for volunteer firefighters when we receive a request from the district or the department. No questions asked. The request comes in. $1,000 goes out. We have hardship benefits, scholarships for both members and family members, and we believe that this is the last bastion of really incentive for volunteer firefighters. As those of you who have worked on the tax credits know, the tax credits are slowly melting away. The rural EMT tax credit, we believe, will not be renewed before it sunsets. OVFA does look at a number of ways to bring funds back into the association. We've done car raffles. We've done telemarketing. Now, just about everything that we can think of. We've also applied early this spring for the for the charitable tax checkoff. At that time, the brick wall that we hit was that we do not have $1 million in the bank. If we did, we wouldn't be here. We do not object to gathering the 10,000 signatures. That's not a problem for volunteer firefighters. It's just that this will allow us to bypass that $1 million requirement. We will still have to make application like everybody else. We will still have to collect the 10,000 signatures. As you probably know, attraction and retention of volunteer firefighters is a nationwide problem. We are always looking for incentives to bring volunteer firefighters and retain volunteer firefighters into the community. We know that times are tough. We just believe that at a time when cities and other governing bodies can't afford to pay firefighters to come in and fill that need, that volunteers are becoming even more important to us, and we think it's important that we give them some type of reward. I'd like to thank Deborah Buchanan and Ken Ross with the Department of Revenue and also the Charitable Contribution Tax Checkoff Commission. This is a relatively painless way to reward those volunteers. I want to address two objections that I'm just trying to think ahead what may come up. Number one, what I heard early on when we talked about this bill is that this is going to open up the floodgates and everybody's going to want to come in and you know, do the same thing. I can tell you gathering 10,000 signatures is, you know, for the most part not an easy process, but the most difficult part was getting a hearing for this bill. And I just don't see that as a floodgate issue. This is a policy decision that's made by the legislature. The second thing I would just say in closing is that, in case you're wondering, well, if they're hurting for money, why do they have a paid lobbyist? I would just like to tell you that I do not have a contract to lobby for the volunteers. I do it because I care about them, and I hope that you'll care about them too. With me is Tina Greiner, president of the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. She pulled an all-nighter last night to be, and she's here this morning without sleep to answer any questions. Jim Ader is our treasurer, and he has some brief testimony for you as well.
Thank you. Please.
Jim Ader, Oregon Volunteer Fire.
And if you'll let that microphone drift away from you just a little bit, we'll hear you better. Thanks.
One of the things that we've been talking about over the year was that we were looking at having to increase our membership dues. We can't do that with the economic times. We're already losing the people that we get for conference. We're probably down 25 to 30% for this conference in 2 weeks, or in a week, I'm sorry. It's inexpensive. It's the lowest conference there is right now for our firefighters. And this is, we don't have a way to increase our budget and offer these programs without some kind of help from the general public. And we feel that this is one of the only ways that we can get this accomplished.
Thank you.
I have nothing further to add. These two are great.
Thank you very much.
She wants to get some sleep.
Any questions for this panel? Representative Berger.
No question, Mr. Chair, but I'm well aware of this issue. My family has had a small frame house in Pacific City, Oregon since 1922, and it has been saved three times in its history by volunteer firefighters.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Any other questions? We'll hear from Mr. McDonald. Yes, sir.
Good morning, Representative Brenner, members of the committee. My name is Mac McDonald. I'm chairman of the Charitable Checkoff Commission and have been chairman since the first term of Governor Kitzhoffer. We have doubled the number of entities since I've been in the commission. We have two more coming in next week, probably. They have applied. I am really concerned that we are really opening the floodgates in a bucket of worms. I am not against the volunteer firefighters. I think it's a great organization. But once we open it to one that doesn't have $1 million worth of business, I think we're going to open it to a lot of others. And I am very, very concerned because it's getting unwieldy now with 25 entities in the charitable checkoff system. The more we get in, the harder it is to watch over all of them. Plus the fact that once we do open the gates, the flood comes. And that's my only concern. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. McDonald? I have one. Could you describe a little bit, just very briefly, the workings of the commission and how many applications you've received in the last couple of years?
I think last, Chairman Barnett, I think last year we had two new ones come in. We have the American Red Cross and the Albertina Kerr Centers coming, applying this year. We are reviewing we're reviewing 12 of the organizations next week to ensure that they follow the legislative guidelines for operating and they don't spend the money basically on administrative purposes.
Now, those are organizations that are already on the list? Or
they're already on the list. They've been approved, and it's about half of them.
Okay.
It just...
Now, let's suppose that they don't follow the legislative requirements. What happens?
The commission will probably put them on probation for 1 year, and if they don't follow the following year, we recommend to the legislature that they be dropped.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. McDonald? Thank you very much, sir. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3414 and open a work session on House Bill 3414. Remind you, colleagues, that we're talking about the Dash 3 amendment. Representative Springer,
okay.
Do you have a motion for the Dash 3?
Yes, I would make a motion that we move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3414.
Thank you. Representative Springer moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3414. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing any, the motion carries. Representative Springer?
I would make a motion that we pass House Bill 3414 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Springer moves House Bill 3414 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Yes, Representative Springer.
Yes, and I guess I need to at this point declare a potential conflict of interest. I don't know that it's an actual conflict of interest. My husband is a volunteer firefighter for the Sile Fire Department, and he hasn't died, so I won't be benefiting there in the near future, I hope. And my son isn't quite ready for college, so I won't be benefiting there. So I think we're at a potential conflict of interest
Thank
at this
you.
Point.
Anything else? Thank you. Your conflict is noted for the record. Is there any objection to the motion to send the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation? I don't see any objection. Okay, with that, the motion carries. Representative Springer, will you carry the bill?
Absolutely.
Representative Springer will carry the bill. We close the work session on House Bill 3414. Colleagues, this may very well be our last meeting. Do remember that we have a special event next Wednesday that you should have been informed of, and we'll look forward to that. But it's not official business of the committee, and I want to just let you all know that I very much appreciated working with you this session. And I expect to work you very hard during the interim. With that, the committee is adjourned.